Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnops, and this is the February Room.
My personal adventures in oarsmanship began in sleek skull boats on Mirror Pond in downtown Bend, Oregon. My parents were fond of athletic activities that started really early in the morning, and I loathed the pre-dawn Asson curb for skiing, swimming, and tennis, but rowing was the exception. Gliding through the glassy waters of the Deschutes River before the town began to stir was an ethereal experience, and little did I know, I was developing a skill that would literally and figuratively carry me for the rest of my days. By my late teens, I was navigating whitewater throughout Oregon and fully ingrained in river life, which took me down a rabbit hole that I've yet to climb out of. Throughout my journey, one brand of oars has always been in the locks. The name Sawyer is synonymous with river life, and I didn't argue when my wife suggested this name for our firstborn son. Our guest today is the Northwest Territory Manager for Sawyer Oars and Paddles. Derek Young, welcome to the February Room.
Good morning.
Well, thanks for joining us, man. We like to start things off here with a personal account from one of your watery adventures. Do you have a tale teed up for us?
Well, your intro kind of made me flashback just, you know, briefly to the first time that I went on an overnight whitewater trip with my family when I was 12 years old down the San Juan River. And, you know, it was my first experience just, you know, pushing off on a boat and, you know, being on the water for days at a time. And, you know, while I was very familiar with water as a competitive swimmer when I was growing up, you know, having everything that you needed and everything you had with you as you floated down the river was quite the experience. And, I mean, just really got the bug for whitewater and spending my life on the water. You know, all the way back then, that would have been, I guess 1983 at this point. I still got that old UDISCO bucket boat from that trip.
Oh, so. Nice. That's what we had, too, when I was a kid. That's what my dad had, yeah.
Those metal valves that, you know, just always nailed you in the wrong opportunity.
Right.
But I think one of probably the most memorable, and it's a story I tell all the time, parts of this trip is, you know, we parked our family station wagon at Mexican Hat at the takeout. And, you know, about a mile above the takeout, there was a man and a woman walking up the river on River Right, and they were both naked. And I thought, wow, this is really weird, and couldn't figure out why they're walking up the river naked. And we got to the takeout, and lo and behold, someone had broken into my mom's station wagon. They busted out a window and laid the back seats down, and all of their clothes were strewn out. You know, at 12 years old, I really didn't understand what that was all about. But I just remember my mom's disgust about having her station wagon being desecrated like that after a river trip. You never know what you're gonna get when you're on the water.
Oh, right. Well, at least it wasn't Dirty Mike and the Boys.
True. That's
right.
True.
Oh man, what a
yeah. So since then I can think of hundreds of events and things that have happened on the water, but you know, it's always some of these things that kind of stick with you. The things that happen for the first time are kind of the things that stick with you.
Oh boy, did she keep the station wagon or just set it on fire?
Oh no. Yeah, we called that thing the safety mobile, and no, it was quickly gone out of the stable of cars. Yeah.
So did it have a trailer hitch on it, or did you just fold everything up and throw it in the back?
Oh yeah, back then, I mean, I don't, you know, we didn't have trailers. We just folded that raft up and threw everything on the top and tied it down. And I remember driving home from Mexican Hat all the way to Albuquerque, where I lived at the time, you know, with a broken rear window and a towel just kind of flapping in the wind, looking out of it, going, "Gosh, when can I get back on the river again?"
Yeah, we had a Suburban. That was our family adventure vehicle. And yeah,
Nice.
same
Yeah.
deal, just everything, you know, strapped on top, tied to the sides. Just any space, no space was wasted trying to cram everything for a multi-day trip into that rig. Well, so you've been you were a professional or a competitive swimmer, as you mentioned. Up until what age did you compete in swimming?
Oh gosh, I think until I was about, well, not much longer after that, I actually stopped competitive swimming because I think my relationship with water just changed a little bit. You know, I wanted to do less, you know, less fighting against it in terms of a stroke and more working with it on a boat. So I quit competitive swimming not too much longer after that, but have always kept that connection to water. So. Yeah, I still swim occasionally, but
And initially, did most of your river trips involve like whitewater stuff
oh
or?
yeah, oh yeah, yeah. You know, so when I started guiding, you know, the picking up the oar strokes for a drift boat and a raft was just a little bit of a different experience because you're used to just forward rowing the entire time, and rowing for anglers is a little bit of a different story. So, but yeah, my background has just been in that in whitewater, and that's why I like to, you know, guide in some of the whitewater stuff because it just adds that element of extra excitement, and there's a lot of big fish where there's whitewater too.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, you know, one of my favorite times of year around here is just right at post runoff when the rivers are high and you know, you can throw a big salmon fly or a big stone fly, and you know, you can do 20 miles in half a day pretty easily, and it comes at you fast. It's just super exciting. Really fun time to float around here.
Yeah.
So was fishing always a part of your life?
You know, I did a little bit of you know, dunking worms when I was a kid. I didn't really fish, you know, seriously. I didn't start fly fishing till, gosh, 1994, 1995. So I was in my, you know, my early 20s at the time. I'd moved to Colorado and for a job, and every morning I rode my mountain bike over the Blue River in Silverthorne. And I had a coworker that was a guide, and I said, "Wow, that looks really cool." And you know, he gave me a rod and a reel and said, "You know, just take it with you when you're out driving around on, you know, during the job, and try to pick it up." And so I kind of taught myself how to do it. And I think that was a good foundation for teaching others, because when you start with zero knowledge about something, it helps you establish a skill set and understanding of how the process works. So yeah, I didn't start until a little bit later in life, but and I don't even remember if that was right around the time when the movie came out. But I don't really know that I can't say that, you know, culture influenced my decision to start fly fishing. I think it was just another way to make a connection with the water.
Cool. So then you became a guide in Colorado.
No, I didn't start guiding actually until you know, I moved up to back home to Washington State. You know, before that, it's a common story. I mean, I'm not the only fly fishing guide out there with a master's degree and probably has some corporate experience, but I worked in the corporate world for quite some time in learning and development and training and different aspects, and just got, you know, just got to that point where I wanted something different for where I was at the time personally and professionally, and started a guide service and did that for 10 years. So
And so initially you were based in Washington?
yeah, on the Yakima River in central Washington.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've never fished that river. I was just fishing with an old friend of mine from Bend the other day, and he had lived in Ellensburg for a period of time after college, and he invited me over there several times, and I just never made it over there. I was still in Oregon at the time, and I wish I would have. It sounds like it's a really neat stream and kind of busy now, like everywhere, but
Yeah, It's got a lot of interesting stretches of water. It faces a lot of the issues that every river in the West is facing right now. I mean, overuse and conservation issues with species and demands for irrigation water. And, you know, right now it's kind of one of those anomalies that it's got a lot of cold water because of the good snow season that that the area had. But in some years, like within the, you know, the first couple of years I started guiding, we were dealing with drought and fire and all kinds of issues. And that's actually what kind of sparked my desire to get into, you know, conservation work. And I looked around and there was none of my peers that were guiding that were engaged at all in the conservation issues that were affecting the fishery. So myself, along with a couple other guys, just started doing some brainstorming, and we started a Trout Unlimited chapter focused on the headwaters of the river and protecting West Slope Cutthroat. So yeah, it's still going.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's still going today. I mean, did a lot of really, really cool stuff for that fishery, you know, in terms of raising awareness about the issues that we're facing it in the competitive world of demanding for resources. You know, that area is growing with housing and people and businesses moving in, and that fishery just kind of keeps chugging along, but it's got its issues and everybody needs to be engaged in their local home water to figure out what they can do to protect the, you know, protect what they love.
Yeah, no doubt. At what point did you move to Montana?
Oh, just about a year ago.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, gotcha. It had been a goal for a long time. My daughter went to school out here at UM. So we just kind of followed her out here. But you know, when the pandemic hit, and I mean, I've always worked remotely with Sawyer. But when the pandemic hit, my wife was able to work remotely. And so we just kind of looked around at what was happening with the housing market and said, you know, let's go. We've talked about doing this for a long time. So let's just go fulfill our dream and move out to Montana. So we're just past a year living here, and yeah, loving it.
Well, you picked a good little community to move to. I won't disclose the name of it. Yeah, we recently purchased a little cabin up there as well. Mm-hmm. That we've been, you know, renting out with a long-term goal of you know, just keeping it for ourselves eventually, hopefully. But yeah, it's really a nice place up there on the lake. Super yeah. cool. Love
yeah.
it. And you also are a ski instructor in the wintertime, right?
Yeah, you know, I did it for a season last year at the local hill, and you know, quite honestly, I thought there were a lot of things from guiding that I could transfer over in terms of teaching people, but it was just a completely different beast on skis. Yeah, it was interesting to do that for a season.
So you're probably not going to continue with that?
You know, I don't know. You know, I faced probably the same thing that everybody faces when they start something new is, you know, you're the newbie. So you get all of the, you know, you get all of the folks that have never, ever gone, and you probably get some of the problem children and, you know, just to kind of see how mentally tough you are in the whole scenario. I'm like, yeah, I don't know that I really want to do this.
Yeah, I hear you.
I've taken a few steps in life to get to a point. I don't know that I want to start all over again, but sometimes that's the nature of the beast. Yeah.
Right. Right. I've thought about trying to do that a little bit myself. And I used to be an alpine ski coach here in mm-hmm. Missoula, you know, but those were racers and yeah. most of those kids were better skiers than I was.
Yeah.
And I was up at the hill this winter and, you know, kind of watching that whole process. And I was like, nah, no thanks. I don't think that's for me at this point in my life.
Well, and I think it's just a very good, I guess, crux of what happened, you know, what last year was and the year before that was, and the growth of what's happening in the outdoor industry, not just in floating or fishing. Everybody wanted to get outside. And, you know, if you were a Boy Scout, you know, that motto of be prepared, a lot of people just aren't prepared for what it means to be active in the outdoors. They don't understand the requirements for gear. They don't understand, you know, interacting with the weather, interacting with other people while they're doing this, you know. So I'd get little kids that come out with their parents and have no gloves, no goggles, no hats. equipment that was ill-fitting. It's like, you're just not going to have a good time if you're not prepared to do this. And that's probably my, the biggest thing is that, we've got lots and lots of new people coming into the outdoors, whether, no matter what the discipline is. And there's sort of this mentality of, well, if I fail or I do this wrong, I can just hit the reset button like I can in a video game and just start all over. And that's just not the case.
No. And, we're seeing that a lot in fly fishing too.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, and it's funny, like I feel now, like a lot of days, I feel like it's my first guide season because here I've got newbies again, which I haven't had to guide a lot of newbies over the last several years. And, in reference to kind of what you just said, this kid the other day hops in the boat, he's got cotton sweatpants on, cotton shirt, no sunglasses, it falls out of the boat, right out of the gate, not out of the boat, but went to go relieve himself on the shoreline, slipped, fell in, and now he's soaked head to toe. And, I set him up in fleece and gave him glasses, and I'm like, okay, this is how we dress for this particular activity. But, there's a lot of novice activity out there right now for sure.
Yeah. Well, and I was on one of the upper stretches of the river, last weekend, with a good friend of mine and that we've had lots of river trips together on, and, just watched a couple of guide boats come in and, back in, and their clients got off and we're standing around and talking. And I heard a lot of the, a lot of the familiar questions, like, how do we get back here at the beginning, at the end of the day?
Yeah. That old thing.
And then, I wanted to just kind of, because I still work closely with, with guides, and not only what I do for Sawyer, but also with the Guide Relief Program, which is a new organization that started up, last year. Really focused on the overall health and well-being of Montana's guide community. So I kind of wanted to just, take a, an outside look at what was still happening with the daily interaction of what happens when people get on the water. And I was like, I'm guessing I'm going to hear some of those old cliches and I'm going to watch a process. I just kind of want to see, what guides are doing these days in terms of new people coming on the water. And it was, I'm like, watch, he's good. That guide is going to ask those people, so have you ever played golf or, anything like that? Just to kind of get a good understanding of, what they were going to be dealing with that day. And sure enough, first thing, trying to get a baseline for the experience for the day. And I think in our aspects and, most aspects of our lives, understanding what that baseline is critical. But it was just kind of humorous to hear that's exactly what's still happening these days, which is good.
Yep. That's definitely been my my life over the last couple of months for sure. It's been a lot of that.
Yeah.
Well, my growing up, my dad and his cronies, they ran the old Sawyer smokers. Mm-hmm. And then I remember my first pair of Sawyers, I had Sawyer lights, presumably because they were better for my health than the straight smokers. Right. But, now I'm lucky enough to own a pair of the VLAM shoal cut square tops, mm-hmm, which are mm-hmm. awesome oars.
That's what I'm rowing this summer.
I got mine last year. And the choice of most of the guides around here. Can you tell me about the design and the materials used in those oars?
Well, the square top specifically, is a Douglas fir product. So, that wood comes to the factory, pre-cut into, individual lengths of product that the guys, the experts there at the factory will grade. So, think about a 50 foot long, semi-trailer stacked, 6 or 7 feet tall with just skids and skids and skids of wood. They'll use a forklift to get it off the truck and they'll go through it piece by piece, grading it for quality. The best stuff they'll use for square tops the stuff that gets a B grade or a C grade might be used for handles, or it might be used for paddles that have a shorter piece. But everything starts as, you know, as a raw product that has to be dried and cured and sanded and turned on a lathe and rested and then shaped, sanded, put into a varnish room. You know, the various components that comprise the ore shaft, whether it's got a rope wrap or a pro tip around the perimeter of the blade. You know, those are all steps that take place. It takes about 14 days to make a square top from the point that it started to the time that it's cured. If everything goes perfect, you know, everything's handmade. So it just takes some time to do this, but the square top is a Doug fir product, and that wood, it's lightweight. It's got a good amount of flex to it naturally. And we're able to shape it in ways that makes that ore a performance tool versus just a utility tool. Whereas a fiberglass shaft or it's just going to be a tube that you put a blade on, and it doesn't perform the same way that a square top does. So this the invention of the square top, isn't Sawyer's. You know, the square end of an ore is something that's been around for a long time, but the ability to tune that ore shaft, if you will, to a specific purpose and for a specific performance aspect is really what's been unique to that product, and the reason why so many guides go with that ore is, it just makes your day on the water so much easier.
Yeah, no doubt. They're super light, very tough, and the shape of the blade, you just get really good draw, good pull. What's the VLAM in reference to?
So the VLAM is just kind of a moniker for not only the look of the product, but also that it's a wood blade. So it's got a little bit of, it's got some different woods in the blade itself. Every square top that we make has a wood blade, but not all of them have the different kinds of wood in the blade. And that's what makes the VLAM so light and flexible, is that it's a little bit more of a flexible ore blade, made of different types of wood. And it doesn't have that carbon fiber overlay on it that gives it some stiffness and a little bit more durability. People ask about, what ore is best for them, and, we're really down to the point like fly rod manufacturers were a while ago about talking about a flex profile. And the VLAM is, probably one of our lightest feeling ores that we have because of the way that it's constructed, but it's got a really, really nice flex to it. It's very easy to row, very easy on the shoulders and the elbows, and it just makes rowing any boat a real pleasure.
And the shoal cut just refers to the design of the blade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the other analogy I'll use is that a shoal cut is more like a spoon in the water versus a knife blade, because the traditional whitewater or paddle, shape is sort of that rounded rectangular shape, which is great for whitewater because you're using that for different purposes. Well, when we started using more, oars more for controlling drift boats, and, as the evolution of the drift boat has come along, you've got boat builders that are thinking about the types of things that they want to be able to do on them, and they want their owners to do on them. And then they're incorporating that ore type into the equation. So we're really talking about, combining just like a ski boot and a binding and a ski. We now have people that are choosing specific ores based off of a performance profile of a boat and where they're going to use it. It's you can really choose an ore for your boat and the type of water that you're going to float, and you can switch them out when you change places. So, but that shoal cut is really, it's really designed to be like a spoon at the end of the ore shaft that helps you scoop and push more water in lower water than it does a traditional blade shape.
Right, which has been very handy of late. Yeah, I use those oars both for the raft and the drift boat. I used to have two different sets, but I like them so much, and they're so versatile that they're the only ones I'm running right now. And I just love them, man. They're great.
Yeah, and I used You know, I use my shoal cuts for whitewater trips, Middle Fork of the Salmon, the Selway, you know, a lot of big multi-day trips where people are using traditional oars, and, you know, because they're pushing downstream. Well, you start incorporating fishing into a river trip, and now you need an oar that's going to help you do what you need to do between the rapids, but also in the rapids as well. So you see a lot more people moving over to a shoal cut for whitewater, because the boat is capable of doing the types of performance that you want the oar to be able to help you do.
Right, and they really help you ferry too, you know, which which we do a lot of when you're going bank to bank guiding around here.
Yeah.
And now a brief message from our sponsors. FlyLab Reels provides silky smooth disc drags at a click and pull price. Paired with Mid-Arbor Spool for quick line retrieval, the FlyLab family of fishing reels is the best value on the river. With four models to choose from, priced from $99 to $249, you won't find these reels anywhere other than the local CD dealer or at cd-fishing.us. And remember to go fishing.
And are those still made in Southern Oregon?
Yeah, I was just at the factory last week, Talent, Oregon, which is just a real small town on I-5, about 20 miles north of the California border on the north side. Last September, you know, there was a huge wildfire that swept through town. And I remember getting a phone call from Aaron, who is the sales manager for the Southern U.S. and my partner there. He's like, hey, just a heads up, you know, Talent's on fire and we're evacuating the factory. And, you know, we'll give you a call. We figure out what's going on. So for a few hours, it's like, oh, I wonder if the factory's even still there.
Jeez.
And, you know, I saw pictures and videos, and there's a video about what happened on our website. And, you know, I was just there last week and I got into town. And I was like, it made me shake my head about how widespread the devastation and how just massive it was. I mean, banks on, you know, a bank and a grocery store on one side of the road burned to the ground. And on the other side of the road, you know, these, big houses. And then right next to that big house, there was a coffee stand that burned down. So it was, and then you'd go for miles and there'd be nothing but trailer parks that just burned to the ground. So it was apocalyptic.
Wow. And that was the recent fire?
That was September of last year.
Oh, okay. Because they had another big fire down in Southern Oregon. I believe it's still burning, but I think it may be
a little farther to the east.
Southeast, you know, of Talent, maybe, or something.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, you know, flying into Medford, you know, from the time that I left Glacier International and arrived all the way to Medford, there was nothing but smoke in the air the entire time.
Wow, crazy! Yeah. Have all these fires affected the supply of the wood that you guys use in those oars?
I wouldn't say that the fire has affected the supply or where we get product. I think it certainly has. Added a layer of complexity to the logistics of shipping things, and you know, starting last April of 2020 is really when things started going sideways in terms of the demand for product. You know, because last March we had a lot of customers that thought that no one was going to be able to go outside, no one was going to be able to recreate, no one was going to go on river trips, no one was going to float. And so they canceled all their orders. And then it was like a snap of fingers and people figured, oh, people do want to go outside. People are going to do these things. And so we had to restart things. So the factory has not stopped working 7 days a week since April of 2020, trying to keep up with the demand of what's happened for paddles and oars and for water products. And I don't see any relief on the horizon.
No, the opposite. Yeah. The opposite happened. To the surprise of most of us.
Yeah, I think the fires are just sort of a, you know, it's something that's happening on the periphery, but it certainly does affect. I think it probably is more of a mental thing than it is anything. It's just, you know, people want to go outside, but they're don't want to sit outside, you know, all day in the smoke. It's not fun.
No, it's not. So can you tell me a little bit about the history of Sawyer Oars?
Yeah. So this was a company that was started by Ralph Sawyer back in the late 60s. Ralph was a fellow Michigander like myself. I was born in Michigan, but his background was in canoe racing. So he built, he built products for doing that. And then when he finished his career, he moved out to Oregon and hooked up with the folks from Willys, who wanted to see some products made out of wood for their aluminum boats. And so Ralph started making oars for the folks at Willys out of Northern White Ash, and that's where the smoker brand kind of folds into the story in the early 80s. But he started making oars for drift boat, the Mackenzie style drift boat folks in Oregon back in the late 60s. And, throughout the years have had a couple of different ownership groups. We're just celebrating, 54 years in existence as a company. So it's been around for a long time. Certainly materials have changed, and with the advent of carbon fiber and incorporating that into oars, it's really become, a product and a brand that is known for the performance aspect of its product. It's not just a utilitary tool. It's not just a tube with the blade on it. It's something that people are realizing that, I can have some performance with what I'm rowing and have a better time on the water. So, it's been a pleasure to work with Sawyer for, as a representative and as a manager for the company for the last 3 years. But I worked with Zach and the crew for, while I was guiding it as an ambassador and helping with demos and stuff like that. So
cool. And the rise in the popularity of stand-up paddleboarding kind of created a whole new market for you guys too, probably, huh?
We make a fairly good line of stand-up paddleboard paddles. You'll find some of the same componentry, carbon fiber, wood, in those products. I started paddleboarding a few years ago as well, and really enjoy that aspect of being on the water with that board. And if it floats, we make a paddle or for it.
Yeah, I'm just getting ready to head to your home waters. I've never fished in Michigan, and I'm going to head out there later this week, hopefully, and take my stand-up paddleboard and go poke around out there. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, that's what's kind of cool about those, that you can fold them up and take them with you.
Oh, they're so versatile. Yeah, I mean, the one I have, like a lot of them, folds into a backpack.
Yeah.
And you can hike it into lakes. I've got a buddy that takes his. He's got it set up, and he's got some sort of, special oar design that he came up with, so he can take it as a carry-on. And, takes his to Christmas Island in the Bahamas and all over the place. So, yeah, they're very cool. Yeah, that's a very versatile fishing vessel.
Yeah, they're fun to have along on river trips as well. We just strap ours to the back of the raft and, ride it through the class one stuff and class two stuff. And it's great to play on at camp when you get to camp early. And, they're fun.
Awesome. So, in addition to your role with Sawyer, can you tell me a little more about the Guide Relief Program? I know very little of that.
Yeah. So, the Guide Relief Program was started, right when the pandemic hit last year, because Molly and Kinsley, both work in the industry. Kinsley's a guide, and Molly works with Sweetwater Fly Shop over there in Livingston. It was created during the very starting, phases of COVID. And the basis of it is, if you look around at, the independent contractors in this state have very little support in terms of what's available to them, whether it's mental health, physical health, insurance, financial aspects of doing their job. They're basically running their own businesses, which as an entrepreneur I've done, but not everybody has that acumen, that's required to really be successful at it. But it was really,
that's an understatement.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really kind of designed, there's 1800 fly fishing guides in the state of Montana. It was really designed to help them navigate some of the resources that were available to them in terms of unemployment insurance and grants and loans, mental health services, that, you know, just weren't, those dots weren't being able to be connected by, you know, by these folks that are out on the water, because it's just not part of, you know, what their world was. But now, now it is. So, you know, that one of the very, you know, few groups of people that, you know, an independent contractor, you don't get unemployment insurance if you can't work because of fires or illness or anything like that. So, yeah, a big part of it is kind of folding in advocacy work, conservation work, you know, but a big part of it is just sort of that that whole aspect of providing a suite of resources for these professionals that do so much for their local communities, but also for contribute to the, you know, to the massive economic, you know, benefit that fly fishing and guiding provides to this state. So there just wasn't really a safety net for them now. And now that there is.
Very cool. And this was started by these two females, Molly and Kinsley, you said?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. So Kinsley guides out of the Missoula area. She goes all over the Northwest.
Oh, yeah, I know her. Kinsley sure, Scott.
Yeah. It's really a great program. You know, when Molly, you know, when Molly asked me to get engaged with, you know, with this program, I was like, you know, I want to stay connected to the guide community. It makes sense, you know, because I work with Sawyer and I have experience guiding. You know, how's this all going to work? And you know, what really is the purpose here? And she asked me to actually be, you know, the chair of this board. I was like, oh, well, okay, let's see what we can do with this. So, yeah, it's really a great program. They did so much legwork to get this thing going. And you know, there was lots of hurdles to overcome from, you know, both internally and externally. I mean, trying to figure out how to start a support organization during a pandemic was challenging in its own, but also having to navigate the very complex, you know, sort of, and I hate to say it, but, you know, fly fishing and outfitting in this state can get political.
Yeah.
and very territorial, you know, and very territorial.
No doubt. I feel fortunate in Missoula. There's definitely some of that that goes on. But I feel like the guide community around here is fairly unified relative to the other guide communities that I've worked in.
Well, and you really, I mean, you know, big picture, you really have to be, because you may depend on that person to save your ass in a very, you know, a very complex situation. And I would assume that everyone would do it for a fellow human being, but guides sort of have this, you know, this extra responsibility when they're on the water, that if they see something, they've got to do something. And I can't, you know, on both hands, I can count the number of times I've had to rescue, you know, recreational floaters that were drowning in the river because they just weren't prepared to go into the water, and got to tell the clients, bring your rods in. We got to go rescue that person that's drowning. And they're like, what?
Right.
Yeah. We got to go rescue that person that's in the river that's drowning. So hold on.
Yeah. I had, you mentioned the Willy boats, and, my dad bought a used Willy boat, and I think it was 1981 or 1982. So it was one of the first wide bottom guide model Willys that they had produced. Mm. And I borrowed it for my maiden voyage down the Mackenzie. And this was probably in the early 90s. I'm guessing I was probably 17, 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd run it with my dad several times. He made it look pretty simple. I'm sure you've probably run that river before, and that rapid in there, Martin's Rapid. So I pulled over to scout that, and you know, I'm looking at it for the longest time, and I'm reading the guidebook, and I don't see a line in there. And you know, I finally just decide, all right, I'm gonna go for it and do my worst. And there's a big suck hole in there, and it caught my right oar. And it pulled my right oar out of the lock, and I'm going back into the suck hole, and you know, surely we're gonna sink the boat. It's like panic time. And right then, the oar came up out of that back eddy, and I reached over, and it landed in my hand. The grip landed in my hand, and I pulled it in there, put it back in the lock, and spun out of there. and made it through miraculously. What's one of your close calls on the river? I'm sure you've got tons.
Yeah, lots of them. I ran the Selway a couple of years ago. I got invited on a trip. I got a phone call like on a Friday afternoon. You know, got a call. Hey, you want to run the Selway? You need to be at the put in next Wednesday. And they're like, oh crap, I got to find somebody to do this with. You know, got to the put in and read some of the guidebooks and looked at all the rapids. And I was just thinking about, Ladle, which is one of the huge rapids on this river. And depending on the flow, you know, there's different lines, of course, to run anything. And the crew that I was with, they were all experienced whitewater folks, and everybody was good. But, you know, we showed up at the put in, my buddy Eric and I, and everybody had helmets with them. I'm like, helmets? Why do you guys have helmets? And it became pretty apparent why everybody was wearing helmets, you know, when we got to these rapids, because they're pretty gnar. So, you know, before you run Ladle, it's a lot of the stuff on the Selway, you do need to scout. So before you run Ladle, you've got to do like a 2.5 mile scout, you know, walk down to the rapid and see what's going on. And so there was a couple of groups in front of us, and a couple of people chose the same line. A couple of people chose the chicken route, which is, you know, stay right. And a couple of folks flipped their boats going into it. And I was like, oh crap, this. But they took some weird lines. So we chose a line that started kind of river right, and then went right towards the gut of it, ferried left as far as we could, and just really kind of played pinball through this thing. It turned out to be a really fun line. But the risk and the consequence was there. There's all kinds of videos about Ladle on the Selway. If you Google it, and it's a hairy one, and got through that one just fine. And then, you know, thought, okay, that's, we can do this. And then, you know, couple of rapids later, popped an oar lock, lost an oar in the next one, and right in the middle of a class four, and had to, you know, pull an oar lock out of my dry box within, you know, 15 seconds of time. It felt like
mid-action.
Yeah, it felt like 3 seconds, but it actually about 15 seconds. But, you know, reach up, grab a spare oar lock out of the dry box, stick it in the frame, put the split ring on it. Get the spare off the side of the boat, and then go through another class four. And it's just like, holy cow, these things come at you pretty fast. But
yeah, and that's not something that you would generally practice. But you should. I mean, you should. I guess. Yeah, you should.
You should. And so that's actually, whenever I can, and I think this is good advice to give anybody that goes in the water, is whenever you can, try to put yourself into increasingly, you know, challenging situations that you can recover from, so that when they happen to you in real time and fast, you have some muscle memory, so to speak, about what to do. You know, which side of the boat do I go on? You know, do I high side? Do I low side? Do I grab the oar? You know, do I jump out of the boat?
Right.
Those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's I took a swift water rescue course many years ago, and I'm gonna refresh myself on that here this next year. But yeah, just, and the, you know, little things like that. Just taking the time to practice getting your spare oar off the side of the boat and drop it in the locks. Like, that can save your life. A lot of us get too complacent out there.
And that goes with a lot of things. I mean, we live in bear country, and where we're at, there's really nothing else around us. So we gotta be mindful of how we store our food, where we walk at night, how much noise we make.
Right.
It's all around us. You can't just take a casual stroll at night up here without having bear spray and, you know, sometimes a sidearm.
Right. Yeah. Well, Derek, what's the best way for people to learn more about Sawyer Oars?
So paddlesandoars.com is the product website. I get a lot of phone calls about, how much does this oar weigh? You know, how do I put these things together? What's the best oar for me? And paddlesandoars.com is really a great resource. Most of what you'll find is, product descriptions. Length, materials they're made of, best application, sort of a description for them. But really, if you dig a little bit deeper, we've tried to do a really good job of giving people not just the information, but the application and how you might use them or work with them. So, for example, if you need to, rewrap your oars with rope, we've got a video on how to do that. If you need to put new grips on your oars, we've got a video on how to do that. So we're really trying to expand, the conversation in an online way, because people get their information that way these days. You know, hey, if you need to know how to do something, Google it. And sure enough, we've got that, there, whether it's the form of a video or an audio file or a link to something else. A lot of these questions you can answer by just looking at the website. And then, honestly, a great resource for finding out more products is that, ask somebody that rows them, because there is a certain level of fanaticism to people that row Sawyers, and they can tell you all about them.
Yeah, and for God's sakes, don't leave your square tops in your truck or in your boat. I think next to gravel bikes, that's the number one hijacked item in our area.
Well, they're in such high demand these days that, it's amazing. You go out to, a lot of the river towns in this state, and you drive through, neighborhoods, and your boats are just laying out unlocked, oars are laying in boats, unsecured.
Yeti coolers.
And, the opportunity to do bad things is certainly there. So you have to trust in the best intentions of your fellow human beings. But yeah, I mean, you drive by a drift boat, and there's, $2,000 worth of gear that is very, very easily taken. It's, it amazes me sometimes, but.
Yeah. Well, I put mine under lock and key every night.
Yeah.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com, where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spend, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.